This is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump is in Brussels taking part in a two-day NATO summit. Shortly before arriving, he tweeted that many countries in NATO are not only short of their current commitment of 2%, but are delinquent for years in payments that have not been made. He spoke about it before leaving Washington.
It's not a question, really, I think, of European powers being delinquent in their payments or owing the US money in this sense. I think that there's a recognition that European countries do need to spend more on defense and are working towards that. There are an estimated 15 or 16 NATO countries which will, I think, reach the 2% GDP target by 2024. But the commitment on their part was always to work towards that target. That is the language in the commitment, rather than definitely, definitively reach that target.
Security analyst Joe Burton, a senior lecturer at the University of Waikato, New Zealand, who said spending will likely be the top issue at the summit. He said Mr. Trump has mischaracterized the nature of the commitments made by other member states. Mr. Trump is also expected to affirm U.S. support for the NATO Charter Article 15 provision, whereby an attack on one member is considered an attack on all. A spokeswoman for the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights said Tuesday that more than 230 civilians were killed and dozens of women and girls raped in attacks earlier this year.
In attacks by government and allied forces and armed youth on these villages in opposition-controlled areas.
The global agency said elderly and disabled civilians were burned alive in the attack on dozens of villages between April 16 and 24 in Unity State in what could have been war crimes. This is VOA News. The Trump administration has raised the stakes in the tariff war with China, announcing late Tuesday another $200 billion of Chinese imports covering thousands of products could be subject to 10% tariffs by the end of August. Christine McDaniels, a senior research fellow at George Mason University.
This is starting to look like this tit-for-tat escalation is starting to get serious, and this administration is not fooling around. I mean, if you read USTR's 301 report, it paints quite a compelling picture of 21st century economic espionage by China against U.S. firms. And not only is the Chinese government looking the other way, but it also looks like they might be facilitating, if not outright sponsoring, these acts.
The U.S. has already proposed or imposed tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese products. Chinese officials said such tit-for-tat tariffs will destroy Sino-U.S. trade. The last four boys and their coach were safely brought out of a flooded Tom Luang cave complex in Thailand, ending a more than two-week ordeal. In all, 12 boys were brought out four at a time, aided by members of an international cave diving team, guiding them through narrow, slippery passageways in murky waters while submerged. Jill Valanthian is the mother of one of the British divers involved.
It's very unusual to see your son on television and everybody saying so many kind words about him. I mean, is this my son they're talking about? And then when they lost one of the members of the team, again, it makes you realise that these things do happen. And I knew that I wouldn't be happy myself until we had a perfect result, which I understand we have now.
The astonishing rescue mission, hampered by monsoon rains, was monitored globally. A suicide bomber blew himself up at an anti-Taliban rally in northwest Pakistan Tuesday, killing 12, including a candidate in this month's election. Peshawar Police Chief Jamal Qazi said it was a small meeting of the Awami National Party. Dozens of others were wounded. There was no media claim of responsibility. In Afghanistan, a suicide bomber killed a dozen people in the eastern city Jalalabad, an attack claimed by Islamic State. UN envoy Martin Griffiths met Tuesday with Yemeni President Abdurrabbu Mansur Hadi in Aden in a renewed effort to broker a ceasefire to end the three-year conflict. Cuba says it's tightened controls on the communist island private sector. The new regulations go into effect in December, aimed at slowing wealth inequality, tax evasion, and a black market. On Wall Street, the S&P 500 closed Tuesday its highest level since early February, with strong earnings reports cited by investors. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Wednesday, July the 11th, and here are some of the stories we're covering for you this morning. Ivory Coast President Alassane Ouattara named a new government a week after his government's resignation. The changes come amid increasing divisions within the ruling political coalition over who would be its candidate for the 2020 presidential elections. And in Sierra Leone, the government will launch a commission to investigate accusations of widespread corruption under former President Ernest Bai Koroma. And Nigeria's opposition People's Democratic Party, PDP, says that the group is working with 36 other opposition parties to wrestle power from its incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari in next year's general election.
The parties have come together to have a joint presidential candidate that will stand for election in 2019.
That's PDP spokesperson Kola Ologbondian. And Zimbabwe's opposition parties this Wednesday are protesting against the country's electoral commission, which they're accusing of plotting to rig the upcoming elections in favor of the ruling ZANU-PF party.
We will not be robbed and just keep quiet. I know some people are saying it's not necessary. Come, let's march. This is history in the making. We are resetting how citizens participate.
Zimbabwean activist Pastor Evan Ngarire is one of those arguing Zimbabweans on social media to swamp Harare streets. Those stories plus sports are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. In Sierra Leone, President Julius Maada Bio says that he will launch a commission to investigate accusations of widespread corruption under his predecessor, Ernest Bai Koroma. A recently released report commissioned by Bio accused Koroma of taking the economy to the brink of collapse. The former president's party says that this commission and the report are nothing but a witch hunt against Bai Koroma. Since Bio took over, former Vice President Victor Fo has been charged with embezzling money, while former Mines Minister Mansare Minkailu has been charged over his role in the sale of a stake in a mining project. And in Ivory Coast, President Alassane Ouattara has named a new government after dissolving his administration last week. This comes amid a row between his RDR party and its ruling coalition partner, the PDCI of Henry Konan Bedie, whose support helped the president get elected in 2011 and 2015. Analysts say that there are disagreements and increasing divisions within the ruling political coalition on who should be the candidate for the 2020 presidential elections in Ivory Coast. A spokesperson for Nigeria's main opposition People's Democratic Party, PDP, says that the group is working with 36 other opposition parties to wrestle power from the incumbent president, Muhammadu Buhari, in next year's general election. Kola Ologbadeyan says that the president has failed to carry out his core mandate, which he says is to ensure the protection of life and prosperity. The multi-party alliance aims to come up with a single presidential candidate for the polls. Buhari supporters say he's got a solid record of fighting corruption and terrorism in the country. They credit him as well for jump-starting the economy to improve the lives of Nigerians. For more about the opposition alliance ahead of next year's elections, VOA's Peter Clotty reached the PDP spokesman, Kola Ologbondeyan. He was in Nigeria's capital, Abuja.
Yeah, the People's Democratic Party is in a working agreement, a coalition with about 38 other political parties. In the area of security, in the area of our territorial integrity, in the area of the standard of living. The parties have come together to have a joint presidential candidate that will stand for election in 2019. And the essence of it is to provide a better leadership that we currently have and to guarantee a living standard that is far higher and far better and what we currently enjoy.
Bakola, supporters of the president are saying that the evidence is there, very clear, that Nigeria's economy is doing better now despite the 2016 recession that you went through, and that President Muhammad Buhari has jump-started the economy with agricultural reforms, infrastructural investment, and all that, and that it will be difficult for him to be defeated in 2019 general election. Your take?
The economy of a nation is not just measured by indices drawn out by the parchment. The economy of any nation, good or bad, is determined largely by the conditions of living of the citizenry. As we speak with you today, the economy of Nigeria is worse off than it was in the year 2015. A liter of PMS, of fuel, what we call gas, was sold at 67 naira 50 kobo. Today, it is sold for 145 naira. If you can buy in the city, where you are out of the city, you can go as high as 200 naira. And the truth of the matter today is that Nigerians have been in the worst living conditions that they were 3 years ago, when President Muhammad Buhari assumed office.
Buba Galadima, one of the former stalwart supporter of President Muhammad Buhari, broke away and has joined your coalition. Some people are saying, how can he be trusted when he was making all the efforts to get President Muhammadu Buhari elected as president of Nigeria, and that the tension between him and the APC could be resolved and he will return to where he came from? That could leave you with eggs on your faces and ineffective in your challenge next year. How do you respond to that?
The working coalition is not about individuals. It's about Nigerians. It's about the desire of majority of Nigerians today who are of the opinion the administration of President Muhammadu Buhari terribly bad and has been inept and has not been able to fulfill the litmus of his campaign promises to Nigerians. And as a result of that, the opposition today is not about the People's Democratic Party. Neither is it about a particular political party, but it's about the result of the will of the majority of Nigerians who have become traumatized under President Muhammadu Buhari administration and determined to replace him through the electoral process, through the ballot box, and bring forth a more competent Nigerian who will deliver to Nigerians.
How will these political parties, opposition political parties, resolve or come up with the modalities to present one candidate to represent the coalition in next year's election?
The resolution yesterday was to sign a memorandum of understanding, which is acceptable to the majority of the parties that are in the coalition. The next thing is for the parties to come together and agree on the modality to achieve a joint presidential candidate. But before we go into that, it is needful for me to quickly inform that some of the parties in this coalition will actually join the People's Democratic Party. But there are some of these parties also that will stand on their own, retain their independence, and work in consonance with the People's Democratic Party as a larger coalition group. But the bottom line of it, of all this, is that at the end of it all, the joint parties are going to come up with a joint presidential candidate who will be acceptable to majority of Nigerians and are able to the generality of these coalition parties.
That's Kola Ologbondian, the spokesperson of Nigeria's opposition party, PDP. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Cloti from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Zimbabwe's opposition parties are this Wednesday protesting against the country's electoral commission. They accused the commission of plotting to rig for the ruling ZANU-PF party to win the July 30th elections. As Sebastian Mofo reports from Harare for VOA, Amnesty International is arguing political parties to utilize the absence of former President Robert Mugabe to respect human rights as the basis to kickstart Zimbabwe's moribund economy.
This Wednesday, opposition parties are taking to the streets protesting against the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. Pastor Ivan Mawarere is one of those urging Zimbabweans on social media to swamp Harare streets this Wednesday morning.
We are marching to the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission, KUZEK. We are marching there to register our displeasure at the way that they have been handling the process of preparing for elections. Let's go there and let's deliver our message of saying we are not happy with the preparation. We will not be robbed and just keep quiet. I know some people are saying it's not necessary. Come, let's march. This is history in the making. We are resetting how citizens participate. We see you there. Let's make this happen.
Police has indicated that it will not block opposition parties led by Nelson Chamisa of the Movement for Democratic Change Alliance from protesting to the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission offices. They want the elections body to release the voters' roll to be used in the July 30th polls. The opposition parties say the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission is holding the final voters' roll to insert ghost voters, thus plunging the country into another disputed election. But Tuesday, police said it was hopeful that Zimbabwe's July 30th election will be the most peaceful one, thanks largely to the departure of former leader Robert Mugabe. Here is Cheri Charamba, Zimbabwe police spokeswoman.
The prevalence of violence this time around is less as compared to previous elections. And the obvious reason is that His Excellency, the highest office in this country, has been preaching peace throughout. And as a result, there's compliance from all political parties. There's commitment, there's political will that there's no violence.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa took over in November after Robert Mugabe ended his nearly 4 decades at the helm of Zimbabwe after giving in to military pressure. On Tuesday, Amnesty International Deputy Director for Southern Africa, Muleya Mwananyanda, said political parties contesting for Zimbabwe's number one job on July 30th must take advantage of Mugabe's absence on the ballot paper and do away with the disregard of human rights and impunity, which was characteristic of the 94-year-old regime.
Amnesty says as the country holds its first election without former President Robert Mugabe on the ballot paper, it is time for Zimbabwe to break with decades of gross human rights violations. With Mugabe gone, there's a real opportunity for a fresh start for Zimbabwe and a chance to break with history and ensure that human rights are fully respected in the context of the elections and beyond. Zimbabwe can only become a thriving country when human rights and the rule of law are the key guiding principles of society. Anything short of this will only shortchange the country of its full potential. Zimbabweans deserve better. All politicians must publicly commit to addressing impunity for human rights violations and put human rights first.
President Mnangagwa is locking horns with MDC's Chamisa together with other 21 presidential hopefuls in Zimbabwe's first election without Mugabe. Whoever wins that general election has a huge task of breathing life into Zimbabwe's moribund economy, characterized by a collapsed social sector, heavily dependent on Western countries and acute cash shortages, as well as government's failure to meet its financial obligations. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
South Sudanese living in Uganda have welcomed the new planned peace deal aimed at bringing an end to more than 4 years of fighting. They say that ordinary citizens have suffered enough and leaders must do everything possible in their power to stop bloodshed in the world's youngest nation. Some are also pessimistic about this new peace deal, a proposal involving former allies turned adversaries. From Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
David Chol left Juba when the fighting erupted there in 2013 and stays in Dubai refugee settlement in western Uganda. Chol, who sometimes travels to Kampala to visit his relatives, says all parties to the conflict must be involved if lasting peace is to be attained.
We are requesting the mediators, President Bashir and President Museveni, who are mediating this peace, to bring all the people together so that we get a real peace in South Sudan. But if the peace between Kiir and Machar, then the other opposition parties are out. You see, those opposition parties, all of them, they have guns. And if there's few people, even three people remain in the bush, means there is no peace. So we want to get the real peace.
The proposed arrangement reached in Kampala this weekend will see rebel leader Riek Machar reinstated to the post of first vice president and will be assisted by three other vice presidents. A similar power-sharing agreement that had Machar as the first vice president collapsed in 2015. Salah Peter says he was surprised to hear there will be many vice presidents and expanded number of a cabinet.
All the mediators, they have to go to consult almost everybody. Then. So it will be the South Sudanese, all the parties, when they agree, when they see that these terms will work. It should not be an agreement that is imposed on them, just like what happened. The first agreement which was signed in 2015, that agreement did not materialize. So
a section of rebels has already rejected the new peace deal that proposes 45 members of the cabinet and 550 members of the transitional national legislature. Johnny Manyang is grateful neighboring countries are helping bring peace to his nation.
We as a South Sudanese, we must change of killing our people, killing each other, tribalism, whatever. We need our neighbors to help us to bring a good peace in our country. We are tired because of war. If somebody read the history of South Sudan, it starts from 1974 until now. Our people, until now, they don't get the rest.
Apuli Kasaija, a professor of international security and political science at the Makerere University, says this is the last chance for the two leaders to forge a way to work together again. He says the international community must compel the two leaders to bring peace to South Sudan.
Salva Kiir and Machar, to the best of my knowledge, see that people cannot work together. So making this guy the first vice president again, we are going back to the 2016, the 2013 and then 2016 situation. Nobody seems to have an answer. But if this deal can stick, if the regional leaders can make it work, then I think then South Sudan has a chance. I think this is the last chance that they have. And everybody has been talking about this being the last chance.
The fighting has resulted in thousands of deaths, forced 4 million people to flee their homes, according to the United Nations. 2 million of them fleeing to neighboring countries, mainly Uganda, Kenya, Ethiopia and Sudan. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The government of Ethiopia has been undergoing some of the most unprecedented changes in the country's recent political history. These changes under the leadership of the country's new Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed continue to surprise many observers and activists who for many years had been calling for the kind of political reforms that would allow for basic freedoms such as free speech. One of those activists who has been outspoken on the need for change in his country is US-based Ethiopian activist and artist Yadesa Pojea. He joins me in studio this morning to give us an appraisal of some of the recent political reforms in his country.
God listened to our prayer, and the new prime minister was actually doing a miracle right now. That's the only way I can describe it. Some of the changes that he made are unbelievable, to say the least. Cover some of them is the freeing of prisoners, and not just about the freeing of prisoners, but to talk about how the government is also because the argument was always that people who are against the government are considered terrorists, and the anti-terrorism law is what actually put them in jail. But the prime minister made himself clear. He said, "We are the terrorists in some cases."
He made that very powerful speech in front of parliament, where he called out his government. It's very unheard of in Africa or anywhere in the world where the leader blatantly calls out his own government some of gross human rights abuses.
Exactly. And what that do is not just for us, but also for people who are actually running prisons and things like that. It gives them a perspective of what the new government will be. For the government to move forward with reconciliation and peace, they have to actually recognize what they did is wrong. And he did it as the head of the government. And that is a titanic change. I don't know how can I explain it, because we never heard that before in Ethiopian history, where the government actually clearly put a blame on himself and say, this is why we have to release people. Even when you see the rhetoric of the person himself, when I see his BBC interview, it just shows you how powerful this gesture of love and peace can be for people. Mm. And we saw the same thing in the Eritrean government, where Eritrean government not even look eye to eye. But in a very short time, Prime Minister Dr. Abiy actually accomplished to change not just the situation in the country, but also the mindset. Mm. And people are now crying and hugging and kissing, and which has never been happened. And it seems to me it's only just not only changed the two country relationship, it freed a lot of people to unburden themselves from a continuous struggle and hate towards each other.
And so a lot of progress has been made on the front of recognizing some of the abuses that have been happening, that have happened in the past. What do you want to see next happening in some of the kind of reforms that are necessary on this path? Some have called it a path to healing.
Well, the path to healing is not always smooth, and sometimes it's bumpy. And we see there are some remnants from the government, the older government, that still did not change their ways. Mm-hmm. And they criticize the government and also trying to create some confusion here and there. The prime minister spoke about it clearly, and the attempted assassination of himself in the capital city is one of the example of how these people are not resting.
Yadesa Bojia is a US-based Ethiopian activist and artist. He joined me this morning in our Washington, D.C. studios. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. And now for some World Cup news with Samson Amali. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good morning, Jackson, and welcome to the latest update from the 2018 FIFA World Cup here in Moscow. France has qualified for the finals of the 2018 FIFA World Cup.
Tolisso! Another save from Courtois. And it is over. Allez les Bleus! All the way to the World Cup final. Brave Belgium eliminated.
Samuel Umtiti's 51st-minute header sent France into the World Cup final with a ruthless 1-0 win over Belgium in an absorbing first semi-final on Tuesday. Didier Deschamps' side will face England or Croatia in Moscow on Sunday as the French look to lift the trophy for the second time following their triumph on home soil in 1998. In an enthralling, albeit highly tactical, rather than incident-packed match, it was once again a set piece that proved decisive, with Umtiti near-past header from an Antoine Griezmann corner settling matters. Didier Deschamps was full of praises for his side. On the part of the Belgian manager Roberto Martinez, he was left frustrated by his team missing out to a set-piece goal, a familiar outcome in this tournament. France can begin to prepare for the final at the Luzhniki Stadium, eager to avoid a repeat of the 2006 finals when they were beaten by Italy on penalties in Berlin and the pain of the loss to Portugal on home soil in 2016. In the meantime, Russian President Vladimir Putin has congratulated his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron on Team France's victory over Belgium and advancement into the 2018 FIFA World Cup final, the Kremlin press service said early on Wednesday. The Russian president, who made a phone call to King Philippe of Belgium, who was also present at the game, noted that Team Belgium has demonstrated supreme football throughout the entire championship. The second semi-final of the 2018 FIFA World Cup will be played on Wednesday between Croatia and England at the Luzhniki Stadium in Moscow. The two teams will meet for the eighth time overall, but for the first time in the World Cup Finals tournament. Croatia have been very impressive in this year's World Cup as they won all their group games, which also included a 3-0 hammering of Argentina. Croatia's run to the World Cup semi-finals may be a surprise to some, but coach Zlatko Dalic said his players had long been among the best in the world and are ready to go down in history as another golden generation when they face England on Wednesday. England manager Gareth Southgate believes his team are nowhere near the level they will be, are nowhere near the level they will be capable of reaching in the future, he said on Tuesday ahead of the World Cup semi-final against Croatia. And that is the latest update from the 2018 FIFA World Cup here in Moscow. I am Samson Omale. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
And that's it for this Wednesday, July 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a very good morning, Africa.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
The 31st African Union summit has wrapped up in Mauritania with advisory decisions on Libya, Somalia and South Sudan. The significance of the African Union with Deputy Chairperson Kwesi Kwarti on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.